Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
Jordan is on Best. Harper's on Miller.
They play together, they believe. And Caris LeVert is cold.
LeVert, back in. Speed.
Oh, he's a one-man wrecking crew.
Holiday, shot clock down to six. Finds Warren.
Welcome to the second ever edition of the joint Indy Cornrows Detroit versus Everybody pod. This is your host, Mark Schindler, joined by, I guess you're my co-host in this, Lazarus Jackson. Laz, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing good, man. It's weird. Like, I'm a guest and also I'm a co-host. It's like I'm a guest and a co-host. But no, I'm doing great, yeah. Man. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate being here. Solid win for your Pacers and very, very solid tanking loss for my Pistons tonight.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little before we got on, and I've thought about it a bunch every time I watch the Pistons play. I think this is the greatest tanking team of all time. It's got to be up there. It's definitely top five. Like, I just think there's nothing that I can dislike about this Detroit team in terms of what they put on court. Like, I mean, I don't love watching Mason Plumlee play, to be completely honest.
That's fair.
I don't think anybody does. Like, he's out of all the Plumlee brothers, he's probably the most like aesthetic to watch, which isn't really saying a lot. But I enjoy watching this Detroit team. Like, they're in pretty much every game. Troy Weaver has finessed the tank mode well without really robbing fans of a truly fun season to watch. At least that's my perspective on it. I don't know what it's like. I keep up to date with everything going on in Detroit. I obviously know you and James pretty well, but I imagine fans still aren't super happy about being 12-31 now, but I enjoy watching the Pistons play basketball.
Yeah. I think a lot of fans get it right. I think having the young kids in Sadiq Bey, in Isaiah Stewart, and even like a little bit in Saben Lee, having those guys be good right away, like really just ups like the fan engagement and enjoyment, even in a season where you've already lost 31 games out of the possible 72. And so like there's a very clear vision of the future, right? This also gives a lot of confidence in Troy Weaver as a talent evaluator. Right. Like with the knowledge that we're going to have a pretty high draft pick this season, we'll like still you got to go through the lottery and everything. But like, you know, staring at like at least a top seven pick at the absolute worst, like the seventh pick in the draft in the face, like, you know, you have a guy who you can feel get that pick correct, which was not always the case in the past, as evidenced by like previous Pistons drafts. Right. Like, you know, we're used to like Henry Ellenson and Stanley Johnson, like dudes who, you know,
hey, you mean the Raptors
killing it for the 905? Yeah.
And no, they're killing it. Well, I mean, I don't know if you can say killing it. Stanley's been fine, but yeah, Henry played like 25 minutes in an actual Raptors game. I'm like, oh boy, that's where the Raptors are at right now. So
first team all G League Henry Ellenson. Yeah. So it was like having guys that contribute at an NBA level instead of at the G League level, I think, is a big boon for Pistons fans and their enjoyment of how the season is going. Jeremy Grant's also been nice. Can't ignore that.
So before we even talk about the game, that's one thing I want to talk to you about, because again, I don't watch every single Detroit game, but I try and catch one or two a week to really keep up to date. And a lot has been made about his efficiency drop, and I don't really think it's fair completely. Like, yes, his efficiency has dropped, but also, I mean, he lost Derrick Rose, he lost Blake Griffin. I know Blake Griffin was not good, but he could pass and handle the ball and just a smart player. And he, even though he wasn't a shooter, he had like some gravity a little bit, you know, not anything crazy. DeLon was out for some games. I mean, it's not like Jeremy's just completely fallen off a cliff, and he had a fantastic game tonight. So I don't know if you feel differently about the efficiency drop, but I feel like maybe part of it's just statistical regression happens. But at the same time, I think people kind of undervalue the fact that, hey, you know, he lost a lot of offensive talent around him, and it shows.
Yeah, the efficiency drop is definitely noticeable, but it's really hard to blame him when the second best offensive player on the team in the starting lineup is like Mason Plumlee.
Hey, that's a ratio of conference player of the week, Sadiq Bey.
Sadiq Bey, I mean, come on, yeah, man. But Sadiq has his ups and downs, right? Like tonight, yeah, he had a pretty good game, but you know, game before against Chicago, he was what, 1-for-9, 1-for-6 from three. Mm-hmm. So like, he's a rookie, right? He's a 21-year-old rookie. That stuff happens. It's hard to count on him on a consistent basis. The thing that's important for Jeremy is that even though, for this team at least, like even though the efficiency has slipped, the production has remained the same, right? Yeah. You can still rely on him for 23, you know, 5 and like, you know, 2 or 3 assists maybe. And so just having a floor of somebody who can score 23 points a night just really helps this team persevere night in and night out. Because again, if you look up and down the roster, like, there's not really that many other guys on this team who can put the ball in the basket on a consistent basis. Guys have nights, right? You saw like Wayne Ellington had a big night tonight. That's been something that happens. You know, Steve Bay can have a big night from three. You know, DeLon Wright can score 20 every once in a while. But from a consistency basis, like Jeremy Grant's really the only guy who's putting like pressure on the rim and stuff. And I think the other thing, like that you were talking about missing Blake and Derek, right? And again, like Blake wasn't that amazing. And Derek honestly wasn't that amazing either in his time in Detroit this season. But like Blake was still drawing double teams. Like they were weird respect double teams, and they were definitely lessening as the season was going along. But like, you know, just having other players on the floor who could bend a defense was particularly like useful for Jeremy Grant. I think Jeremy Grant getting this experience as a number one option, as a guy who's having to shoulder a lot of the burden of self-creation, like will be good for him on a future like version of the Pistons. But it's like it's a hard, you know, it's a hard road to plow right now.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with that sentiment. And I think some people have taken it the wrong way. Like I've seen multiple people say, oh, well, you know, he's hitting the note, like of course he's hitting the efficiency drop. He should be doing it like the exact same role he was with the Nuggets. And I just completely like vehemently disagree with that. And I, not to be a dick, but I just flat out say, okay, you haven't watched the Pistons play this year. Like, he's legit. I mean, you saw like tonight, that fadeaway step back has become like a legit shot for him. I don't remember who he hit it over right now. I think it was over Justin Holiday in the fourth quarter down the stretch. Like he's doing stuff that he was just flat out not doing last year. And like you're mentioning, like I think a lot has come out, a lot has died down now too, about the potential of Jeremy getting traded. And that's just like, I mean, in my mind, that's a non-starter unless it's for like an all-star or like 4 or 5 first round picks. Obviously, okay, that's an exaggeration, but you get what I'm saying. Like he's been fantastic. Like maybe he's not a number one guy on a championship team. I mean, he's probably not, but like he's something on a championship team or the next version of the Pistons, which is more than you can say about the last 2 or 3 years of Pistons basketball. So that's my rebuttal to people, and especially anybody who listens to my pod that thinks that Jeremy Grant is like a tradable person right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you got to remember he's got the relationship with Troy Weaver.
Exactly.
Right, Troy Weaver, you know, known him since his days at Syracuse, just been really involved with him in his career. You know, Weaver came out and said, like, you know, during the, or before the trade deadline, no one's untradeable. It's like, we'll listen on anybody. But then, you know, you got the reports about the Celtics offering like only a couple of second round picks for Jeremy Grant, and being told kind of flatly like, no, it's gonna take more than that, or it's gonna take some better picks than that. And so I do think Jeremy's here for the long haul. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, speaking of other guys who are just fantastic, Edmund Sumner tonight was that's my leadoff. We're gonna talk about Caris LeVert too, but to me, Edmund Sumner exploding tonight was even more like just incredible. I actually photoshopped his face onto a prime Ray Allen. Edmund Sumner hitting off the dribble threes, sidestep threes off of closeouts. Like, I was so impressed with his game tonight. And this was fantastic. It sucks for Aaron Holiday, who notably did not play the last game the Pacers are going to play before the trade deadline. Which is,
and I'm going to ask about that later.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. But basically, point being, I didn't expect Edmund Sumner to really have a much of a role on this team this year, and it really seemed like it was going to go that way at the beginning of the year. And now he's really carved out. He played 16 minutes tonight. You could have argued. Pacers ended up winning, but I think they could have probably ridden him a little bit longer in the fourth quarter with how hot he was. And he was contributing well defensively too. He finished with 3 assists, but he could have had 5 or 6 because Goga Bitadze missed like 2 wide open layups at the rim off of some fantastic reads. He just was supremely confident tonight, looked great. And he's, it was probably the best game of his NBA career or right around there, which was awesome. I love watching Ed play, and just looking at the confidence in this game compared to stuff he was doing like 2 months ago is like, it's mind blowing. It's awesome to see.
Yeah. I mean, like, and think about what it's taken for him to get to this point, right? It's taken, Aaron Holiday, a dude who was starting games for the Pacers last year, just like, you know, being, you know, pushed from the rotation, like you said. It's taken like TJ Warren's injury for like him to get these minutes. Even with a guy like Caris LeVert and Jeremy Lamb, like back in the lineup for the Pacers, he's still, you know, proven enough while those guys were gone to, you know, put himself in a position to take advantage of these minutes. And Edmund is a dude I've had a lot of, I've had my eye on him for a while just cause like me and him went to the same high school. So I've been aware of him for a while. He's always been able to play, but he's always been a very like weird player. Right. And it feels like he's starting to put things together offensively in a way that wasn't the case earlier on in his career. Like the move he put on Isaiah Stewart in the fourth quarter, the extension finish over Beef Stew, like that was a pro move. That's a starter level NBA like rim pressure attack. And so I'm very curious to see like how this continues going for Sumner, right? I firmly believe he can be a rotation player in the NBA, like at the absolute least. And you know, with everything that's happening with the Pacers right now, you know, they're going to be playing guys who can just help them win games. I think Sumner is a player who can do that, and I want to see more. I want to see him continue, you know, to play well and get these minutes for that Pacers team.
Yeah, definitely. And just to point out, I mean, without even including tonight, over his last 12, which is when he's gotten a consistent role, so he's playing 16 minutes a game since February 26th, which is crazy to say that that's already a month ago. This year is like nuts to me. But 46.5% from the field, 36% from 3 on 2 a game, almost 90% from the line. He does not take a lot of free throws, but he's been getting there a little bit more. It's been good to see. He's doing a lot of quality stuff, and obviously tonight was a trademark game for him. So, I agree. I can't wait to see what he does more of moving forward. We'll talk a little bit more about trade deadline stuff later on. Have to talk about Caris LeVert. Caris was easily his best game as a Pacer so far.
This is game what, like 5 or 6 for him?
I think this is game – I'm looking it up right now. I should know this off the top of my head. I think it is 5. I want to say it's 5. I'm kidding. It's game 7. Damn.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. Time has no meaning. But yes, this was game 7. But I mean, his splits before this, 38% from the field, 30.5% from 3. So expected. I mean, he's coming off of a pretty significant ailment. So makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. This is what the Pacers were hoping for. Like this type of performance, I guess, is what you expected the Pacers to hope for, like in that trade, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
A guy who could create his own shot, a guy who they can run crunch time offense through, obviously hits the step back that really seals the game for Indianapolis. And, you know, gave them a lot in the latter half of he scored a bunch in the second quarter and in the fourth quarter. Just a guy who they can rely on to give them buckets like down the stretch of games, which is a big thing that the Pacers were missing, right? Like that was one of the struggles of that Indianapolis team, earlier when they were in their kind of funk, right? They couldn't close games. I'm remembering like the game against the Knicks where Sabonis had like a really great night, but you know they just kind of fell apart down the stretch because no one else but Sabonis was having a good night. And so just like adding dudes to the roster who can play, adding dudes to the roster who can give them buckets. I think that's really big for Indianapolis at a time when the spot that they're at in the Eastern Conference is in a lot of flux, right? Like that whole like 5 through 11 chunk in the East is like really tight. And so adding a dude who can help you there, really makes a lot of difference. Sorry, I'm watching Milwaukee Boston.
I've heard bad things about Milwaukee Boston from my friends Boston. I think it was Celtics blog actually tweeted out the perfect. Oh wait, that game is close now. Holy crap!
Yeah. Yes.
I have the mistake of my computer setup is not faced towards my TV. It used to be. I'm gonna rearrange it tomorrow because I'm realizing how ridiculous that is now. But yeah. Regardless. Oh well, I mean, Giannis isn't even playing.
So no, he's playing.
He is?
Yeah. What? Yeah.
Okay. I looked at this wrong. Well, gosh. So that tells you, okay. Well, just to give people an idea of Pistons fans, the Pacers lost, gave up 140 points to the Giannis-less Bucks the other night, and Boston is almost beat them. So that's two different states of the team, you could say.
But hey,
to be fair, Malcolm Brogdon and Miles Turner didn't play. But
yeah, but like at the end of the night, right? Like Indianapolis won, Boston lost. Like that's another team you're scrapping with at the bottom of the Eastern Conference standings, or not the bottom, but like the bottom of the playoffs of the Eastern.
I mean,
Conference
close. Standings. Yeah, I don't know. Did Chicago play tonight? I think Chicago played tonight.
Chicago is playing tonight. I don't know where they're at.
Well, yeah, because they're tied with Indy right now for the 9 seed. So if they lose, Indy's one game behind on Boston.
Okay. Good Chicago stuff. Is currently losing to Cleveland.
Oof. Cleveland's actually been better lately, but that's still an oof for Chicago.
Yeah. More good results for the Pistons, right? Like, you know, a Cleveland win be nice for the tank. A Detroit loss, obviously good for the tank. Let's check on. I can check on Minnesota in a second. Minnesota was playing the Mavericks like terribly. Yeah.
See, what's hilarious is that Detroit. We have two of like the opposite top fives. Like Detroit, top five tanking team of all time. Minnesota, top five not tanking team of all time because they're 10-33, but they're not trying to be 10-33. Like this is a team with Carl Anthony Towns on it. They just traded for a max player over the off season. Obviously, they've had like a really weird year. But still, I talked to, I don't know if you know Dane Moore, but he does some really great stuff covering the Wolves. And I talked to him not that long ago and like, it's they're in a weird space, but anyways, back to the game. I mean, I want to ask you about some of the young players for the Pistons really quick, because I talked to you about this the other day on, Isaiah Stewart's shooting becoming a thing. He took a three tonight. He missed it, but, his face up game is becoming kind of legit. And it's been cool seeing him just find confidence and comfort in taking some of those shots. And it's totally changed my perception of him. I mean, I know from talking to some of my friends who cover the draft, they thought he was going to be somebody who would shoot eventually, but not this early on and not looking this great early on. I mean, how has that kind of changed your outlook on how you look at him?
No, that has definitely elevated like what I envisioned like the role Isaiah Stewart would play in the NBA long term, just because like you pair that with the improvements that he's made on the defensive end as the year has gone along. And like that stuff is more typical. The defensive improvements is more typical for like a rookie big man, right? They kind of learn on the job. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a guy who can face up and splash like, 15 footers, that opens up stuff in the short roll. We didn't see much of that tonight, but he's also kind of like flashed that. You have a guy who can space it out to three, has been willing to take threes in the second half of the season and knock them down. I think he had like a week stretch where he made like five threes in a week and we were like freaking out because he was taking them and he was making them. But yeah, like having a guy like that you can pencil in as a like starting level center on an NBA team for the next like 5 years, like that's really big. Like you don't have to go looking for a center, in the draft, right? If one from USC happens to fall into your lap, you're not disappointed about it. But yeah, it just means you don't have to like allocate a ton of resources towards what is rapidly becoming like the least important position in basketball. But yeah, it's crazy how confident he was in his shot, or he's becoming his shot right away. Like earlier in the year, we were getting, you know, reports from the beat writers, from James Edwards, saying like, yeah, man, Isaiah Stewart's like, he's taking these face-up jumpers before games. Like, he looks really good doing it, and the coaching staff thinks he'll be able to do it. And you, like, you hear that and you internalize that and you're like, okay, cool. Like, you know, in year two, like, we'll start seeing some of that. And then, like, maybe in year three, he's like a 35% guy or whatever. And then he comes out in the second half of the year and he's just like taking them with full confidence, to the point where, like, when he missed tonight, like, I was a little bit surprised because he was so open. I thought it was going in. And it's just like getting to that level so quickly, accelerating that timeline so quickly is just, it's way beyond like anything we had a right to expect as Pistons fans going into this season, which is like a theme of the year with these young guys. Like, all these young guys have been much, much better right away than we had any right to expect.
Yeah, and I mean, just like Jason Tatum, he's 19 years old still. So I mean, like, there's a lot that can that you can expect from him. He looks on court, I mean, like, you're like, oh yeah, he was like a 3 or 4 year college guy. Nope,
he's just jacked.
Yep, exactly. but no, I'm really excited to see what he can do moving forward. But also, I know his playing time's been down a little bit, but what have you thought of Saban? Because I really have enjoyed what I've seen from Saban so far. I know he's not really a spacer or anything yet, but like, watching him go head-to-head with TJ McConnell was kind of fun tonight for that little stretch of time that happened. Just brings awesome energy on the court. I remember, like, I was watching live because there wasn't a Pacers game that night when he got his first minutes. Or, like, he had that first big game when he started.
Against Orlando.
Didn't start. I mean, against Orlando, yeah.
Yeah.
I like him a lot moving forward, too. I mean, like, there's stuff to be happy. And Tyler Cook, I know he's not necessarily a young guy. I was watching Tyler Cook play, and I was like, this guy would be a really great backup for on the Pacers, and he's playing for the Pistons right now because they didn't find him out of the G League. I know he was, like, awesome in the G League this year, but.
Yeah. Saban, the thing, it's funny, right, because Saban's, like, this insane athlete. This dude who tried to murder Brooke Lopez and failed, but it was still a great try, right? He tried to murder Nikola Vucevic and failed, but it was still a great try. Pre-draft, he's known as like this insane athlete guy. But what's really impressed me the most about him is his patience, right? He's been a really patient, like, pocket passer in the pick and roll, which is not what you expect from that type of guy. Like, normally the guys who are just so much like quicker and faster and can jump higher than everybody, they don't have vision, right? Because they're so used to just using their athleticism to get where they want to go on the court and do what they want to do. But Saban, like, also, like, ties in that element of patience where he's, like, setting guys up. He had, like, great chemistry with Stewart, like, when the two of them have played together. He was really impressive. We shouldn't read too much into him not playing, like, the second half.
Yeah,
the Pistons have a big, like, logjam at point guard.
And I mean, Frank Jackson, 29-point score. I think he scored 29 in the game, right? It was 29 or it was, like, 28 or 29. I can't remember. I don't think it was quite 30, but I remember, like, checking my phone. It was 23. Yeah. Okay, well, I can't read numbers. But regardless, for Frank Jackson, scoring 23 is, like, scoring 40. So,
no, for sure. And like, Dennis Smith Jr. had a pretty good game tonight. Despite, like, you know, the couple of people on Pistons Twitter who really don't like Dennis Smith Jr. But
I've been pleasantly surprised by him. Like, not that I think that Detroit should keep him long term or anything, but I felt like he's actually been a solid contributor.
Yeah. And he has. He's just he hasn't been able to, like, Saban has been pretty clearly better than him for one. And Saban is part of the long-term core, so it feels weird to play this guy who's not going to be here long-term over the guy who is going to be here long-term and is playing better. And so, like, there's a little bit of resentment there, I think. The other thing is, like, Dennis Smith has been fine, but he hasn't always been fine in the way he was expected to be fine. Mm-hmm. Like, he's been able to, like, make things happen in the pick and roll, but he hasn't been, like, blowing past guys, right? He doesn't have that quick twitch element that he used to have, like, in Dallas. He can still get up on off of 2 feet, but he needs, like, space, right? And so he hasn't just been able to he hasn't looked nearly as like special as he did like kind of earlier in his career, which is understandable, right? Like after the quad injuries, after like the wrist injuries, after all the stuff he's been through on a personal level, you get it. But it's also like the reason why he's not thought of like as an elite prospect anymore as well. So it's like, yeah, it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B, but I do think he's played well enough to establish himself like in the NBA for the long term. Just like that's probably not going to be in Detroit.
Yeah, definitely. I would probably agree with that. But it's been cool to see him rehabilitate a little bit.
No, absolutely.
His defense has been like kind of okay. Like not awesome off ball, but like on ball, he like holds up at least against point guards.
Yeah, he's been giving a lot of energy and effort on that front for sure.
Which is much more than you can say about his Knicks tenure. So I'll take it.
No, for sure. And like, you know, helping DSJ like rehabilitate himself as an actual NBA player, helping dudes like Tyler Cook, like, you know, show what they've got. It keeps pointing to the Pistons as, you know, pretty good, not only talent evaluators, but talent developers.
Yeah.
Which just like really bodes well for anybody they choose to bring in the future and for like, you know, making the most of any people they pick up in trades or anything in the future as well. Which is like if you can bring in guys and you can identify the good guys to bring in and then help, you know, maximize them through talent development, like that is the way that the Pistons are going to have to win, because like, you know, they're not going to sign, you know, Kawhi in free agency, right? We've talked about this in the past, but like this is like, again, like it's so important to be able to do this stuff if you're not one of the NBA's like glamour market teams.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it's been awesome to see that. And another guy, I mean, Sadiq is the last guy I want to talk about in terms of the young player. We could bring up other guys, but I feel like in terms of looking at quote unquote young core, that's like the group right now. And you could, I mean, Sekou, I don't know if you want to talk about Sekou after tonight's game, but yeah. Sadiq was fantastic tonight. And I know he was really good from the field and obviously from three, but some of the passes he had tonight, he had a couple reads out off a closeout, and I think he had one out of pick and roll too. I was impressed by. I know that wasn't necessarily his billing coming out of college, but has the playmaking kind of been a thing that started to grow, or what have you seen out of that?
Yeah, so he really struggled attacking the rim like in his first couple of games.
Yeah, I remember, because I noticed this. I was doing a preview last night, and I was like, holy shit, Sadiq Bey is over 40% from the field, because I remember he was shooting better from three than from the field overall for most of the year. So it's been nice to see that go up.
He was shooting like 12% at the rim to start. And it was just like, this isn't great. But as he's gotten more confident and as he's gotten, you know, more playing time, more reps, he's been able to attack the rim more. And now great stuff from that, right? Like we're seeing, you know, Sabonis like having to close out on him because he's such a good three-point shooter. Him, you know, having the patience to attack that closeout and then find Jeremy Grant on the cut for a layup. Is just like the little things like that where like defenses didn't care if he was attacking on the closeout when he was like, you know, his fifth NBA game. Like they're just like, okay, let's see what this kid can do. But like now that they both know that they have to respect him behind the line and like attacking the rim, it just like opens up other stuff in his game that he's been able to take advantage of. It's been really great to see Sadiq develop into a guy I think is going to be here long term for Detroit. The Pistons have just like sorely needed just a capable team defender, dude who can knock down three-pointers and like also do a little bit of some other stuff, that it was also like 6'7", 6'8", and thick. Like they haven't had that guy in forever. And so like, yeah, like it's been great to see Sadiq's progression. Like he's still inconsistent, right? He's still a rookie. Talked about the 1-for-6 against Chicago like earlier this week. But like, you know, prior to that, he had, you know, 28 against the Raptors and was like 6-10 or 6-9 three, I think. And so, like, yeah, he's been up and down, but like his heights have been really high and just really impressive for this business team.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's like really interesting too, moving forward, like not to lock everything in, but like Sadiq and Jeremy is a fantastic starting duo moving forward, like already defensively. I mean, Sadiq's going to grow and become a better on-ball defender as he gets bigger. I mean, like, he's still probably going to fill out a little more, add some meaningful weight. But, like, already, like, the length and team defense between them is fantastic. Like, Jeremy, I tweeted out because Karis was starting to cook, and then Jeremy had that block on him that was just like, oh my God. I was like, if Karis doesn't score again tonight, I would understand why. But that was, oh man, yeah. I just like, I think I look at basketball differently than some people. Like, a lot of people get, and I'm not trying to hype myself up for that, but like, I don't know. I just see like the potential of this team, and like, it's there. Like, they still need like a lot more creation for sure. Like, if Sadiq and Jeremy is like your pair moving forward, okay, you're missing a lot in terms of playmaking, but I don't know. I really like them. But back in looking at the Pacers, though, one thing I didn't even mention that I think we've hit on a little bit, like, getting that downhill ability is what's so important. And I think you saw that with Karis tonight, and that's what was huge that I think hasn't really flashed consistently for him yet. And something that I know has been a thing for him is, like, he's got the capability to get downhill, but he's a lot more comfortable pulling up sometimes from, you know, like, 8 to 18 is like his range. But he got to the rim probably 7 or 8 times tonight. It felt like not everything was a finish, but like he had some good dump off passes. He's really started to develop a pretty good chemistry with Domas. And Domas didn't even have a great game tonight. But I mean, he was still solid, but like 5 of 13 from the field, like, well, that's not really a great Domas game compared to what he normally does. But the way that Karis was able to bend the defense and just get open shots for everyone else was something that the team's solely been lacking. And you can just tell, like, I mean, I'll ask you just based off this game compared to last, like, the difference in scoring gravity that the team has with Karis on compared to what they looked like a month ago when they played is like astronomical, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, the last time we talked, right, like, Domas had a really nice night.
Yeah.
And it was at the point where it's like, if Domas doesn't have that night, like, the Pacers just lose, right? And now that's not the case because they have a guy like Karis who can come in and fill that void offensively. You know, LeVert, like, led the team in shots, right? Like, I forget if we were talking about this in the podcast, we were just, like, talking about this on Twitter, was, like, you know, if Brogdon's leading the team in shots, like, that was not necessarily, like, a great thing for the Pacers earlier this year. You know, LeVert is taking on that burden. Even if he's not like classically like the guy you think of as like, you know, the best offensive player on a championship team or whatever, just like him being able to do that and putting everybody else in their, like, you know, secondary, tertiary roles offensively is just like a huge value for making everybody, you know, more comfortable. I was thinking about, you know, Brogdon attacking DeLon in the half court and in transition and in the third quarter, just because, like, you know, he has the juice left in his legs.
Yeah,
because he wasn't trying to carry the team the entirety of the first half because Karis was going off. And then, you know, obviously, you know, we talked about the Karis step back to seal the game. He's still got enough left in the tank to do stuff like that. But yeah, and yeah, it's been like getting Karis and helping having that, like, just makes all the other pieces fit better. Whenever TJ Warren gets back, he will also help just the other pieces fit better. And the Pacers are really close to being a team that, you know, you wouldn't want to play in a playoff series, even if you're like, you know, the Nets, who I'm watching right now and have been terrible on defense, right? It's just like, that's a series that's going to turn out tougher than you want it to be. And I know I can see that's kind of frustrating for Pacers fans, because like that's where they've been the last 3 or 4 years, right? Like in a tougher than they want to be playoff series, but still ultimately coming out at the bottom. But there's a lot there with this team. But I guess this kind of brings me into what I wanted to ask you about, which was the trade deadline. You know, we got the reports that the team is, but listening to offers on Brogdon, and obviously, like, Holiday didn't play tonight. And so I was going to ask, like, you know, with the emergence of LeVert and, like, with, you know, the future return of Warren, like, does that make Brogdon more expendable in your mind? Like, what do you think the Pacers are looking for when they're listing offers for Brogdon?
Yeah, I honestly, I just took it in terms of more – they're, I mean, it's their job to listen, right? Like, I mean, Kevin Pritchard's talked about that in his press conference. He's mentioned that no one is untradeable. You know, we respect our guys. We like our guys, and we're always going to let them know if they're in trade talks. But like, if somebody calls us, we're going to listen and see what they project their value as of our guys. And we want to know what people think. And that doesn't mean that they're on the table. And I think that's how they view Brogdon. Like, I think just in terms of like a community aspect and leadership wise, he is the guy in the locker room right now. He is the quote unquote leader of the team. And in terms of what he does on court, I think it's really hard to envision him not there, especially even for this team. Like, I think ultimately Karis is probably going to be the lead ball handler. At least most nights, I think that's how it's going to be, just because he's a lot more comfortable with the ball in his hands than being off ball. Maybe that'll change up as time goes on. But like Malcolm, as you saw tonight, he's much better attacking a tilted defense. Like, I think getting that initial advantage from Karis is like huge for the rest of the team. But I think this is not me trying to say that Vincent Goodwell doesn't know what he's talking about. But like, I think a lot of people took that in terms of, instead of they're just listening to what people are saying, they took it in terms of, oh, well, then they're fielding offers. And I was like, no, I don't think that's happening. I guess I could always be wrong, but that's just how I took it personally. I actually think the only guys who I would view as, like, I don't even want to say expendable, but like that the team will think about, like, I think it would be more likely for one of the centers to get traded than for Brogdon to get traded, is how I would put it. Cause I think he's, not that he's more instrumental, but it's just easier to envision him being part of the core long-term than having both centers on the core long-term.
This is advertiser content brought to you by Frito-Lay.
Hello, I'm Chip Murphy, here to get you ready for the big tournament. Tonight, we break down who will be cutting. Cut! What are you two doing?
Sorry, Chip. Prez here got his feathers ruffled when I told him Ruffles has zero chance of winning the title.
And I was letting Dip know that she is not taking into account Ruffles' iconic ridges.
Guys, it's March. We have to start talking about the tournament.
We are. It is the 2023 Frito-Lay Snack-It.
We're talking about big-time matchups between Cheetos, Smartfood, Lay's, Sun Chips, and more.
Just head to the Frito-Lay Snack Bracket and vote for your favorite chip, pretzel, or dip for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks.
This sounds great. Keep up the good work.
Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends 4/3/2023. Void where prohibited. Here's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
No, yeah, that makes sense. That's also a big frustration of mine. It's like, as soon as somebody's name appears in a trade piece, it's like, oh, this dude is getting traded. And it's like, eh, that's not really the case. Like, that's not how these things work. It's like, if it was, like, a lot more guys would get traded.
The Celtics would be like stacked, man. It'd be insane. It's
exactly.
Yeah, it's funny though, because when I used to just like be a fan and I just enjoyed like watching basketball. I mean, I enjoy watching basketball even more now. But like, now that I actually cover a team, I'm just like, wow, I just want the trade deadline to end. I want it to be 3:01 tomorrow, so I don't have to talk about this shit anymore and get a bunch of fake trades in my mentions. But it's just interesting how it works out. Like, I mean, looking at the trade deadline overall, I mean, I have questions for Detroit too. I mean, I don't know if you have any more on Indy. We can get to those for sure too. But like, I don't want to say I was surprised that Wayne played tonight, but I was a little surprised that Wayne played tonight.
I think he hadn't played in a while. And so I think they did kind of have to like show like, okay, he's fully healthy.
He's right? Still like alive he's three. So
he can still play. Like, please give us a second round pick.
Yes, pretty much. Do you have any like inclinations that anybody would be on the move? Like, I know, I've seen stuff flash about DeLon, but like, he's been solid for the Pistons. And if you trade him, Killian's still not going to be back for a while. So Saben Lee is your starting point guard. I mean, maybe Dennis Smith is starting, but like, that's, I mean, you go from being like the top five tanking team of all time to like not top five tanking team of all time
real quick. Yeah.
And like, a lot has been made a lot too of, I mean, DeLon is from, I think, Flint area, right?
No.
No?
That's the Casey connection, right? Like, you played
Casey okay,
in
the Toronto. Casey. Yeah, that's what's going on. But yeah, like, so I don't know. That's my read on. I know James has talked about that as well in his pod. And but I mean, what's your sense on anybody who might be moved or anything that Detroit's looking at doing?
I think it's going to be a quiet deadline for the Pistons. I mean, the thing that obviously seems the most likely to me is the Wayne Ellington for a second rounder trade, just because, like, you know, he makes more sense on a team that needs shooting, you know, like more. He makes more sense on a playoff team than he does on the Pistons, right? Like, especially since the Pistons traded for Hamidou Diallo 2 weeks ago, and he hasn't played yet, but they're going to need to space to get him minutes. Obviously, like, Wayne would be one of the guys on the outside looking in when that happens. And so it makes sense for him to be shipped off someplace else. I think DeLon was a lot of teams like plan C, right? But like with not much happening in the trade deadline, and not much time like for things to happen in the trade deadline, I'm starting to think he'll be here at, you know, 3:01 tomorrow. I thought of DeLon as a fit for Philadelphia if they struck out on Kyle Lowry, mm-hmm. right? I've thought of DeLon as a fit in Dallas again. He played in Dallas like last season, and Dallas could use another point guard type with a little bit more size. But, you know, obviously the Lowry stuff hasn't resolved itself yet. And, you know, by the time it does, it might be, you know, 12:58 with no time for another trade involving DeLon to kind of come through. And so, yeah, I like, there's no, and he's been good this season, and he doesn't, and they've already like played him next to Killian. And so there's no rush to, you know, throw DeLon Wright into a trade just for the sake of doing so. And so, you know, and there was also a little bit of rumblings about Mason Plumlee, and honestly, Isaiah Stewart had played so well that, you know, you could see him starting right away and like the team not really missing a beat. But it seems like Plumlee was most like rumored to Brooklyn. And like, that seems to have kind of quieted, that noise is quieted. And also, like, there are a lot of centers available on the market, right? We still got Andre Drummond hasn't resolved his buyout situation. You know, you still got guys like Dwayne Dedman on the free agency market. You know, when Embiid went down, I thought something might happen. But then, like, you know, Tony Bradley scores like 18 points last night and, like, you know, looks solid for Philadelphia. And so, and like, you know, JaVale McGee is out there on potentially in the buyout market.
Have you seen some of the stuff he's doing in Cleveland?
I have not.
Oh my God, man. He's taking like step back threes, and Zach Lowe put it in his 10 things. But I'd also notice, because I talk to our guys, Chris Manning and Evan Damrell, pretty often. And it's just some of the stuff that he does is like, you can tell it is very much so Cleveland. Their offense is, it is an offense. I think that's the nicest thing I can say about it right now. But also, LaMarcus Aldridge erasure, poster. If I've ever seen it, man. You didn't even mention LaMarcus.
I was trying to think of the third guy, and it is LaMarcus. I forgot to call LaMarcus. Yeah, he's out there too. So it's just like, yeah, like, if you're a team and you need a center, like, there are other options besides Mason Plumlee.
Yeah. And it's interesting too. Like, I think it brings up a lot of good points. Like, you could – I think there's a tendency from like fans and just people in general to be like, well, this is a young team. Play the young players. Only play young players. We can only have young players. Just pretend it's 2K and like launch everyone into the abyss for draft picks and prospects. But like at the same time, you have to have guys you can learn from who've like been around there and done that stuff. And I know we've talked about this before too, but I'll bring it up again for people who haven't listened. Like I always bring up the Sixers. Like I think a lot got made that showed like if Philly wins the championship, then of course you're going to say, well, this was a successful experiment for them to do the process. But like, if you really think about it, like it took them a lot of failure to get to the point they're at now. And they didn't have a lot of quality, not to say shit players, but like having like quality veterans who can kind of usher your guys into a new era. I mean, that's important. You have to have guys who are capable of playing basketball still that can gain the respect of the young guys and try and show them like good ways and good habits. Like that's important.
No, absolutely. I mean, like even I think even the 2K example is instructive, right? Because you know, obviously you can tear your team down entirely to the studs on 2K and just like sign a bunch of rookies, but like they put in a progression thing as like the you can like help your guys learn badges from older players who have that badges, who have those badges, right? And it mirrors like, you know, older vets like helping the younger guys just like learn how to be better at basketball. And it's so, but you like, if you don't have those older guys on the roster, you can't, that progression can't happen, that knowledge transfer can't happen. And so it's very important to both like have those old guys on the roster and still have them be able to play. I think that's the thing that's really important. I know, and like that's part of what makes the Pistons, you know, the one of the best tanking teams we've ever seen, right? That's part of what's keeping their net rating, you know, not in the complete toilet. I know that that's been big for some of the young guys. They've talked about this, how, you know, seeing what it takes to like win like every night consistently in the NBA, seeing what it takes like to be ready for that has been, you know, big for their development and being in these competitive situations, being in these close games, you know, losing these close games, but for by and large, but still like getting the reps in like down the stretch of game situations, like has been important for the young guys, and it's stuff for them to build on. This entire year for the Pistons is like about building a foundation for their young players, and I think they've done a masterful job of that.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And talking about young players in development, it slipped my mind to even talk about the Pacers at the trade deadline. Aaron Holiday not playing tonight, which we mentioned before, that's not like the death knell or anything, but he went from playing he was starting at the beginning of the year he was the first guy off the bench to start the year. And then he was starting games after TJ Warren got injured. And then he went back to his role on the bench and then slowly slipped down the depth chart as TJ McConnell started playing better. And now Edmund Sumner has taken over his minutes for the most part. And he's been playing, you know, either garbage time or just some small minutes here or there. And he's been largely out of the rotation for like the last week. And it just kind of is getting to the point now where I think it's unfortunate, A, because I really like Aaron Holiday. Seems like a great dude. But also, he's mentioned as a young player. He still is young, relatively. I mean, but he's 24 almost. He'll be 25 before next season starts. His deal is going to be up at the end of this year, or it's next year. I can't remember off the top of my head right now. But regardless, like, there were offers for him last year, and people poked around about him last year. And now his value is just like totally down. And it's kind of, I don't want to say it's like the Pacers' fault, but it's kind of the Pacers' fault because his value is just totally tanked this year. And part of it is, you know, he was not put in a great role. Like, he's never been an awesome like play finisher. He seems like a guy who's a lot more comfortable having the ball in his hands and getting to operate that way. And that just hasn't been the case this year, but he also hasn't really earned those minutes just with his play overall. Not to say that he hasn't like worked hard or anything. But it is tough to see, because the last month it really seemed like he'd been rounding the corner and finding some real shake in his new role, becoming a little bit more comfortable off the bench. But ultimately, I would probably be more surprised if he, or I guess I shouldn't say I'd be more surprised if he isn't traded tomorrow, but I wouldn't be too surprised if he's traded tomorrow. I know rumblings have come out about it, but I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. Regardless, it seems slightly untenable moving forward without him having more of a concrete role.
Yeah, when I heard about that on the low post, you know, I was, you know, just driving around. I was surprised, not because, you know, I hadn't seen his diminished role. I had seen that, obviously, but because, you know, he's, you know, I thought he played really well for them the last year. And I thought that was enough to kind of solidify him into the team's plans for the future. But, you know, that's obviously proven not to be the case. I was going to ask you, Mark, do you think that Aaron Holiday is as available as he is right now? if TJ McConnell is like not having the season of his life.
Oh, right? Definitely
like,
not.
Yeah, it's like if TJ McConnell isn't, you know, playing out of his mind, you know, in an expiring contract year and, you know, putting himself in the mind of the front office as like a guy who could be the long-term solution at backup point guard, like you think Aaron Holiday would be, you know, less available?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think that totally changes things. And it's interesting because I've thought about it a lot in terms of how everything has gone for Aaron, because I think a lot of people will say, oh, well, he just didn't play well enough to cement his role. And I guess, yeah, that's fair. But I do think, I mean, he was fantastic in the bubble. I thought he had as good of a playoffs as he could have. He was put in a really tough position defensively. And I mean, he had a pretty good year last year. It was really up and down, but he had stretches where he would like start and was fantastic. And then he'd go back to the bench. And by the end of the year, he was like almost out of rotation because Victor was back. And it was just, he had like one of the least concrete roles on the team. That's been the same thing this year. Like he's never really gotten a chance to just be Aaron Holiday in a role. And I think that's gotta be more frustrating as a young player, just a player in general. Like I would rather have a role and know what my minutes are going to be than be kind of just all over the place. Like, I mean, he went from just in like the last week, he went from playing like 21 minutes to six to DNPing to playing 16 minutes the next night. Like that's frustrating. Like I remember like just playing sports growing up. Like I hated like not knowing if I was going to get in or not. Like not to just say I was like a scrub, but like, I mean, you know what I'm talking about? Like
no, it's just it frustrating. Wears on like, you mentally. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's easier to know, okay, I'm not going to be in this situation or something than to be like hoping for it. It's just really tough because you look at 18, 19. So I'm going on a long rant here. I apologize, but like 18, 19, his rookie year, the team that was like the, I mean, that's the Victor team that, I mean, the year that Victor gets injured is 18-19. So they go to the playoffs and get shellacked by Boston in the first round. And he plays 7 minutes. Like that was, they went and they, instead of giving some more opportunities to Edmund Sumner and Aaron Holiday, even though Victor was not going to be there for the playoffs, they signed Wesley Matthews and he was fine and ended up being part of the Malcolm Brogdon trade, which was great. And that worked out well. But you kind of shaft your young players by doing that. Like I get wanting to be competitive, but they knew they were not going to win that first round series against Boston because that's the Kyrie year. I mean, that team was stacked, even though they did not really gel at all. There was no way that the Pacers were going to win that series. Then you go to 19-20 and he starts half the games he plays. I thought he really took some steps, but still had a lot to figure out. And in the bubble, it looked like he really turned that corner. And then it comes to this year and part of my frustration with this year is like, I get where they're going now. But at the same time, I really thought, I want to say that there should be a longer leash for Aaron Holiday, but at the same time, like, he wasn't playing well, frankly, but like when TJ McConnell started taking those minutes and his role shifted again, like, it's just hard. Like, do you keep giving the guy who is your young player that was a first round pick, do you keep playing him 25 minutes a game, even though he's playing like crap? Like TJ McConnell earned that spot and earned his minutes. But at the same time, like, is it better for this team to try and figure out, okay, Aaron Holiday, we've seen at his peak or when things are hitting for Aaron Holiday, he's a more impactful player on both ends than TJ McConnell. He's not the same passer or floor general or whatever, but like he can do more defensively because he's got a longer wingspan. He's got a stronger base. And he's a shooter. I mean, he shot 39% from three last year, which that was what was weird for him this year. Like that just was totally not there. And I think part of that was just all role reversal. He shot like almost 40% from three over like the last month. So that was like the part they were starting to figure out, but I don't know. It's just that's part of the – it's difficult to develop players or to figure out how you're going to develop players when you're a team that's not tanking. Or not even that you have to be tanking, but, like, there just really wasn't – I don't want to say that there wasn't a development plan, but you get what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, yeah.
There wasn't, like, a dedicated role. The Pistons had some of those same problems too. Like, when they were trying to be a team that's making the playoffs, but, okay, well, how are you playing this young guy – enough minutes to figure out what the hell he's doing in the NBA or what you're doing with him in the NBA if you're maybe thrusting him into a role that he's not ready for yet. Like I've thought you know, I kind of just wish that Aaron would get like a month straight of playing, you know, 30 minutes a game, regardless of what happens. Cause you've seen like over the last, I mean, in this entire year, if he has just like a poor stretch or a mistake, he gets pulled. And it's hard to develop through that sometimes.
No, absolutely. And, you know, that's obviously very rough on Holiday as a person. And that obviously like affects what he's going to do on the court. But I was thinking just like even more from like an asset management perspective, right? Like you have this guy who it's the same front office. You took him in the first round, you know, not that long ago. And you're going to choose TJ McConnell, who's playing really well. And I don't mean this to demean TJ McConnell, but like you're going to choose TJ McConnell over this guy you expended a first round pick on at the trade deadline. Like that just feels like a poor management of your assets, right? Like it feels like you've kind of failed a little bit as a team if you can't find a way to maximize this guy that you spent a first round pick on, has shown that he has talent and the ability to play in the NBA, and it's just like you just can't find like a consistent role for him like on your team. Like that's poor, you know, that's poor asset management just in general. I wouldn't be surprised if Holiday is traded to a team that can, you know, make more use of his talents. If he's traded, you know, to a team that desperately needs a point guard, I'm thinking like your Orlando Magic, right? Or even to like a lesser extent, like a backup point guard for like Atlanta or something, right? Like if he were put into a situation in which he would have an immediate role and a dedicated role and be part of that team's long-term future, like I have no doubt that he would thrive, right? And so it's like, as a front office, like do we want to put ourselves in position to, you know, open ourselves up to scrutiny? It's like, do we want to trade this guy who's been like going to blossom into a role someplace else for TJ McConnell? And again, like not to denigrate TJ McConnell, but like that's the reality. It's like those are the tough choices, right? Like I don't envy what Kevin Pritchard and team like are going through right now at the trade deadline.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the last thing I'd say on it too, I know it's been a long rant, so apologies to Pistons fans, but like it's just tough because, you know, like you're mentioning, I mean, he was to their credit. I mean, he was playing above TJ McConnell start the year. And so you could tell that, I mean, it's not like I've ever felt that he wasn't part of their long-term plans. But it's just like he wasn't playing well enough to warrant the minutes, but at the same time, that it's with this year and how everything changed with the Victor trade. Like I think that the perception of the team was like so skewed because they started off well. Like I really thought that there was an opportunity where the team could have, not that they were tanking, like not at all, but I think there's a way to, instead of playing eight guys in your rotation, you play 11 or 12 deep. Like the Pistons played I believe they played 12 guys tonight and they were still extremely competitive. Like you still get Sabin Lee 7.5 minutes. And that was the least minutes that anybody played tonight. Like I just think instead of playing Domas 40 minutes and Malcolm 40 minutes for those 2 months that they did, like that's where you maybe try and play Aaron Holiday even more and try and see if you can help him find a rhythm, like stuff like that. Like maybe you lose 3 or 4 more games, but I think you have to stomach that when you're in a year like this and you're trying to build towards something better than you have been the last couple of years. But I don't know. That's part of the reason why I'm not in the front office, but I also am only 23 years old. So that would help as well. But
yeah, no. And like these are really tough choices. And you know, to shift this a little bit back towards the Pistons, like this is a similar dilemma to what the team is going through with Sekou Doumbouya, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's a lot of the same things where, you know, other guys have played better than Sekou. He hasn't played particularly well when he's been on the court, but obviously the talent is there. Like he has had stretches of effective basketball, you know, the first stretch when he hit the NBA last year. He's looked, you know, really good in the G League for times. And in those times, he had like a more dedicated offensive role. He had a you know, clearer idea of like what he was going to accomplish, like on the court when he was put out there. And so it's like, okay, well, you know, if you have to structure things so that he has like clearly defined goals, but he's also got to play well in order to, like, you know, for us to maintain this semblance of, like, from a coaching staff perspective, like, we have to give this guy minutes. We're giving people who deserve them the minutes, It's like, you have to play better in order to earn the minutes, but he's not. He's not necessarily, like, playing well. And so, you know, Sekou was in some trade rumors. You know, again, brand new front office in Detroit. It's not like a shock that the new front office would want to trade, like, the last remaining player from the previous regime. But at the on the other hand, like, he just turned 20 in December, and it's obviously, like, so toolsy that you want to give a guy like that a shot. And so, like, yeah, it's a similar proposition, but made a little bit different by the fact that this Pistons team is not necessarily trying to win as many games as the Pacers are.
Yeah, and it's hard too, because with a guy like Sekou, like, do you want to throw him into the fire and play him 25 minutes a game? Like, I don't know. Like, how do you trying to figure out how to build a guy up and, like, bring them along like that is tough, because I mean, you said he's played really well in the G League. It's like the same thing with Goga Bitadze. Like, luckily he's been getting more minutes now, and he played decently tonight after he had a rough stretch to start the game, but then he hit that three and it kind of turned around for him.
Yeah.
But with, like, I mean, he was taking, like, I think he was averaging like 20 and 10 in the G League, which is absolutely killing people. He only played like three games because he was just so good. So it just gets to a point. It's like, okay, well, got to figure it out at the next level. And I don't know. I have a good feeling about Troy Weaver making that happen, though. The plan in place seems really good, and everything that they're going through to make that happen. But
yeah, the team site, the writer for Pistons.com, like, conspicuously put out a piece today about, like, how the team is going to make more of an effort to play Sekou in the second half of the season. It's like, okay, it's like, that's like it's basically team PR, right? It was like, okay, team PR says, like, A, he's not getting traded, and B, he's going to play more in the second half. So, like, these are good things, probably, right? If you're a fan of Sekou.
Yes, definitely. Playing players to get them time on the court, important. Like, even Alexei Pokuševski. I don't know how much you followed along with Poku, but, like,
oh, yeah, yeah. I've followed the Poku experience. Yeah.
Well, Cosmos now just draft Brian because of his account, unfortunately, being suspended. Posted his per 36 differences from, like, when he first played, then went to the G League bubble, and now is back. He went from being, like, the worst NBA player of all time to, like, a kind of bad player. So, like, things change. Like, they get better. Like, he was, like, I think his true shooting percentage was, like, almost 45%, which is, like, god-awful. And now it's, like, 54%. So, like, hey, progress. But, yeah, the young players get better, surprisingly. Hopefully, I'm hopeful things work out for Sekou, but we'll see on that end. Unless you have anything else you want to add, I think now is a great time to talk about the Snyder cut for a little bit. We've been
yeah
to do this.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay, you go.
Okay. So my thoughts about the Snyder cut were just that, like, the movie was just functionally too long. It yes. took me an entire, like, day to get through. And I made the mistake, or I guess I don't know if it was a mistake, but I made the decision to watch Infinity War and then Snyder Cut on the same day. Oof. And then I watched Endgame, you know, a couple days after, and just as a point of comparison to refresh myself about, you know, those two franchises. And, you know, even despite my, you know, disappointments with the plot choices in Endgame, it's like, just that experience was just so much more, you know, visceral than anything I felt with the Snyder Cut. That's where I am. I don't think it was bad. It's just like, I just didn't, it didn't, you know, evoke anything from me in the way that those Avengers movies did.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And I think it's different too, because I grew up on Marvel and I never really liked DC that much. Like, I liked DC and I would watch everything growing up, of course, but, like, I didn't feel the same connection to DC that I did to Marvel. And I think part of that was just like, and it's unfair because Marvel really is kind of not a branching off of DC, but I feel like the DC I don't know for sure if DC started off before Marvel. I should know this if I'm going to talk about it, but, like, whatever, we're not a comics podcast, so I don't give a shit. come at me if you must. I'm at M. Schindler MBA on Twitter.
So the thing was like, so like DC Animated Universe, right? Like, like they had higher quality, like animated stuff to build off of than Marvel did in the past, right? Like you think Batman, the animated series is like one of the single best animated series like ever, you know, put on television. Like Bruce Timm and Paul Dini just like did an amazing job with that. Yeah, like Superman, the animated series, just like, you know, not as good as Batman, but like still pretty good. You know, you compare that with like the like, you know, season and a half of like Iron Man, the animated series, which like kind of sucked, or like the Spider-Man animated series, which like, you know, had that amazing intro. So it's just like a real, it was like, that was very much like a kid's show. Right? Yeah. Like I was not like, you know, that didn't go as hard as Batman did. And so it's like, you know, DC like had this advantage in like the storytelling department, and they just like squandered it, like not trying to put together like an entire universe. And like Marvel, the people over Marvel had the foresight to try and like build something in its entirety, that, and like DC is like trying to emulate that, but also trying to condense it into like two movies. It's like it took Marvel 10 years to get to, you know, Avengers Endgame. Like you can't rush this.
Yeah, and I think my biggest issue with DC in general now is that they try and be like Marvel, like we're mentioning. Like it's almost like, all right, compare it to basketball. It's like everyone trying to emulate the Warriors after they won in 15. Like, you can't be the Warriors. You have to win differently because nobody else is going to be what they were. And I think the issue is like, I mean, it's a little bit better. I felt it was better in the Snyder Cut, and they've kind of figured it out a little bit more now. But like, they try and like put in some of the campy humor that Marvel does, and it just like, it doesn't work. Like, I think DC, like the movies are cast, and not in terms of like actual casting, but like the way that they're shot is like, it's much darker than Marvel movies. Like Marvel's just presented in a much lighter tone. At least most of the movies are brighter sets. Like Snyder Cut was gray. Like there was just a lot of gray and dark going on. And not that it was a bad thing, but I think like my point is, I think DC should really just lean into being like the darker side, like not to make it like all about like being like super like you have to be super serious with everything, but I think I don't know, there's just like it's almost like they take it like so seriously in the wrong way. Like I don't need to see Ben Affleck work out for a 5-minute montage in the fucking rain. Like,
right,
we get it, Batman is yoked, but like he's too yoked at this point, to be completely honest. Because I now I feel like he has to be like downing a protein shake in the Batmobile or something. Like it's just some of the ways that they try and make it serious, it just comes off like this is kind of like dumb. Like I don't know, I just there's just like it's like you mentioned too, like they really rushed it. Wonder Woman 1984 was abysmal. I actually kind of liked the original Wonder Woman. And I like Gal Gadot a lot. Like she's a great actress, but like, I don't know. Just, it feels like, I don't love it. It's like adding Josh Smith. Like you know, that's sorry.
It always comes back to Josh Smith.
I love Josh Smith though. Like I'll never accept the hate. Josh Smith was one of my favorite players growing up, but
yeah. Wonder Woman 84 was so weird because it had the same creative team, right? Like same director and everything. Same, I think it was mostly the same writing staff. And it's just like some of the choices they made.
Casting Kristen Wiig in a serious role as a villain was just weird. Like I like Kristen Wiig, she's really funny, but it, like exactly, like how am I supposed to take her seriously as a villain? Like,
it's like, you know, or it's like, you know, Pablo, I forget his last name. But it's like, okay, so it's like, okay, he gets the stone, and then he becomes the stone, and it's like, so now people have to touch him and like wish. It's like this, it's like we're treating this super seriously. Because you know, like we're tying this into like the oil crisis and OPEC and everything. I was like, but at the same time, like he's a televangelist. It's like it's just like a lot of like weird choices that like didn't that like made what should have been like a pretty good movie, like not work. You think about like where it's like if you're building off like the established you know, character, like aging through time or whatever. Think about the differences in choice between like what Wonder Woman 84 tried to do and like what the Marvel did with like Captain America, the Winter Soldier, right? It's like, okay, we have this, we have like this established storyline that we want to go with, this like return of this character that we've seen in a prior movie as like the bad guy, versus like Wonder Woman 1984, like nothing, the only thing that like exists from the previous movie is Wonder Woman. And then they like shoehorn in Chris Pine through like magic and never like really, you know, grapple with the ethics of like how that's supposed to work. And but then, and like they do that obviously because like Pine has signed a deal to appear in like three Wonder Woman movies or whatever, but like they don't make it like work seamlessly like within the plot. And so it's just like, okay, this guy's here because like it, we want him here. It's just like you could make these things work if you like thought them out and plotted them better, but they just didn't. And so like it just looks bad. Yeah, the only definitely. Other thing about the Snyder Cut that I really want to get off my chest is that, like, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm settling in for the Snyder Cut. I'm like, I'm willing to give this movie a shot, absolutely. And then like one of the first scenes we get is like Batman trekking to like the Nordic country or whatever to go see Aquaman. And then we've got like the 3-minute scene where like the Icelandic women are like singing as Aquaman.
Yeah,
like,
that swims was away. Weird.
I was like, okay, I know what I'm in for. And like, I'm like, we're going to some weird places.
Yeah, the music in it was very odd. Some of the music choices were definitely out there. Like there would just be like random like pop songs going off in the middle of like a fight scene, and like they would like it just some of the tie-ins just did not make sense. It was a lot of slow-mo,
yeah,
like extended slow-mo too. But the one thing I would say though, like I really like some of the action scenes were fantastic. Like the also, if anybody's listening and you haven't watched the movie yet, this is your own fault if you're still listening to this point. But like the fight at the beginning with the Amazonians and when Darkseid's I can't remember the guy's name right now. When Steppenwolf comes down initially and has the battle with the Amazonians, that is sick. Like that fight scene is awesome. Like that's the stuff I'm like, okay, cool. I can't sit down and watch a 15-minute fight scene most of the time in a movie, but getting to watch it now, perfect, because I blocked this out. Like, but the other thing, the last thing I would say about Snyder Cut, I just want an like make an entire series about that alternate timeline. That is awesome. Like that was like the most compelling part of the movie was like the last 5 to 10 minute epilogue.
Yeah,
the nightmare. Like just make that an entire movie thing. Like I want that. That is what I want. I don't care about getting your origin story. Like it's at the point where like if you have to keep giving an origin story for Batman and Superman and all this shit, like why do I care? Like if I really care enough, like I know the origin story. Like we don't have to do an origin story for somebody every single movie, you know?
Right. Like no one needs to be introduced to Batman, right? Like we all know who Batman is. Even if you don't know like everything about Batman, you know who Batman is, you know what he's about, you know that like he does this because his parents were murdered. You don't have to show his parents getting shot coming out of the opera, right? Like you don't have to. It's like it's a choice you make, but it's unnecessary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Laz, this was a blast, man. I always enjoy getting to talk, and I'm sure we're gonna have to do it again sometime soon. They're gonna play one more time, right?
Are they? This
was only the second time, right?
This season has just been like just gone on.
Oh, forever. I know. I'm so jumbled up in my head. I have no idea. It's halfway through and it feels like it should be like, I mean, I guess it's further than halfway through now, like 40-ish games. So
somewhere around one more time in April. One more time in April.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely be talking again then. Do you have anything you want to plug before you get out of here?
Yeah, obviously, you know, I'm gonna be cross promoting this on the Pistons versus Everybody podcast, the Detroit Pistons podcast and the Blue Wire podcast network. Obviously you can also listen to me on the Detroit Bad Boys podcast. That's the podcast for the SB Nation site, DetroitBadBoys.com, which you should check out. And you should follow me on Twitter at Last Chance, at LazChance. You can get more detailed thoughts about the Snyder Cut on there. So yeah, that's where you guys can find me.
Fantastic. And yeah, you can find me at MSchindlerNBA. Less detailed thoughts on the Snyder Cut. I think the only thing I posted when I was watching was it's a lot of slow-mo. And that actually got more engagement than some of the things that I say about the NBA. So it was fantastic. Yeah, but you can find all my work over at Indie Cornrows. I host Indie Cornrows Pod. I also do some stuff at Premium Hoops, which is a site that I run with a couple of other guys who cover the league at large. For SB Nation, actually, I will plug this. I had a brief chance to interview Miles Turner yesterday, and I got that up this morning. So talked a little bit about sneakers, the new promotion that he's doing, and you should check that out. It was a good time. Laz, this was a blast. To everyone listening, thank you for listening. Of course, be sure to rate and review both of our shows, by the way. That would be greatly appreciated. We always want to get that feedback.